I call this meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. The first item of business for today is the approval of the minutes, although I don't think that we have a quorum, so. Well, the committee legislative assistant has instructed me that we do in fact have a quorum. But I still don't think that we do, so I have instructed I've instructed the committee administrator to go and find some members so that we can have a quorum. We will get back to that later. The first bill that we have on the agenda for today is House File 4362 from Vice Chair Coulter. Vice Chair Coulter, would you please make your way to the test fire table? All right, Vice Chair Coulter, now that you've had the chance to get yourself settled in there, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 4362 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety, I believe is the motion.
Vice Chair Coulter moves that House File 4362 be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. Vice Chair Coulter, please proceed in telling us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. So, members, I want you to think about someone who is starting their freshman year of college this fall. They were likely born 10 years after Columbine and shortly after Virginia Tech. They were probably in preschool for Sandy Hook and in fourth grade for Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. They were likely in high school for Michigan State. Someone starting their freshman year of college this fall has literally never known life where school shootings were not an everyday possibility. And the fact that I listed all of those names, and I'm guessing most of us knew exactly what I meant, shows just how pervasive this is. And it shows why the demands that we as leaders take action on preventing gun violence have become only more passionate and more frustrated. House File 4362 is a small step to answer those demands. So, members, under current law, private colleges, like all private property owners, are able to prohibit visitors, as well as students and employees, from carrying guns on school property. Our public colleges and universities cannot. House File 4362 gives the power to make those decisions about how to protect staff, faculty, administrators, and the nearly 400,000 students from gun violence to the schools themselves, to our 6 University of Minnesota schools and 33 Minnesota State colleges and universities. I want to be clear that granting this power is not a requirement to use it. And I think it's also important that we be honest that using this power is not a guarantee that we can prevent every shooting. But given the demands that we are hearing from Minnesotans that, as I said, have only become more passionate and more frustrated with every single year, why shouldn't we try?
Thank you, Vice Chair Coulter. We will now proceed to testimony on House File 3462. Our first testifier for the day is Jenna Chernega, the IFO President and Winona State Sociology Faculty. And then on deck, we have Mark Grant. All right, Ms. Chernega, welcome back to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Wolgamott, Chair Rarick, members of the committee, my name is Jenna Chernega, and I'm the president of the IFO. As you know, we represent the faculty, counselors, coaches, and librarians at the 7 Minnesota State Universities. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I deeply appreciate Representative Coulter for bringing this bill. As you've heard, Minnesota campuses can currently not ban visitors from bringing guns onto campus. They can ban employees, and they can ban students from bringing guns onto campus, but they cannot, under Minnesota law, ban visitors from carrying guns. We first brought this bill in 2023 at the urging of our faculty members. Following a work group on campus safety issues, this loophole in the law was identified as a key goal for our legislative work. While there's no single database that isolates college shootings specifically by non-affiliated status of the perpetrator, data from the Violence Project and Every Town for Gun Safety provides a clear picture of this subject over the last decade, from 2016 to 2026. Every Town for Gun Safety has tracked over 415 incidents of gunfire on college campuses since 2013. When looking at the motive and affiliation, 59% of shooters in identified cases were not associated with the college at the time of the shooting. In other words, they were visitors who would be considered to be allowed to carry guns onto our Minnesota State campuses. These incidents are not typically the large rampage-type shootings that make the news. They are most often related to individual disputes, robberies, or spillover from nearby neighborhoods. A longitudinal study by the Citizens Crime Commission of New York, which analyzed 190 incidents, substantiated Every Town's findings and showed that 59% of the 190 shooting incidents they looked at on college campuses were perpetrated by non-associated individuals or visitors. Some notable examples. In 2022, Bridgewater College experienced two campus safety officers who were shot and killed by a man who was not a student or employee. And in 2023, Michigan State University had a 43-year-old gunman with no known affiliation to the university who killed three students and wounded five others. When our faculty members are walking around campus and see that someone has a gun, they can report that person if they can recognize them as a student or an employee, if the institution has adopted a policy banning those groups from carrying guns. But if a faculty member, student, or other staff person sees someone on campus that they don't recognize, someone who seems to not be from campus, and there is no official action that the university can take, and those visitors with guns may go often unreported. Our campuses serve the most marginalized students in Minnesota. MinState educates more first-generation, Pell-eligible students and students of color than the private universities or the University of Minnesota. Indeed, we have more students of color than the University of Minnesota has students. And all of those students, like every student in Minnesota, deserves to attend college in a setting that is as safe as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Mark Grant, Governmental Relations with the Minnesota State College faculty. Mr. Grant, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Of course, Chair Wagamot, Chair Rarick, and committee members, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4362. For the record, my name is Mark Grant. I am both a faculty member at Dakota County Technical College, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty. We're the union that represents nearly 4,000 faculty at Minnesota's 26 colleges across the state. As I have mentioned in previous testimony, providing a single faculty perspective on issues like this can prove challenging, as that perspective can often be as varied as the communities we serve on our 47 campuses on nearly every corner of the state. However, it is also true that all of our legislative priorities come from our faculty board, a board that includes those varied perspectives, and those faculty were clear. Faculty should have the right to address and possibly amend a policy that directly relates to the environment in which they work, teach, and serve students. It's worth noting that when our board introduced this topic, they were unaware that the IFO had brought this exact language forward in 2023. That means, independent of each other, Minnesota's higher ed faculty came up with the same idea. That's exactly what this bill does. It provides the option for a campus to extend its current policy, which covers faculty and staff and students, to the public if they see fit. As our board discussed all the various scenarios a topic like this invites, it became clear that some campuses would pursue a change if available to them, and others probably would not. But all should have the ability. As a law-abiding concealed carry holder myself, and I'm also an exemplary Minnesota State employee. I trust our campuses' ability to determine how to best serve their employees and their students. I also respect their ability to implement policies that reflect the uniqueness and the needs of the communities that they work, learn, and thrive. And for that reason, Minnesota State College faculty supports this common sense legislation. Give our campuses the ability to consult with staff, students, and faculty and create the environment that best serves the community and their mission. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We will proceed with other testifiers, but please stay around for when members have questions. Thank you. Our next testifier for today is Brian Ghosh, the NRA Minnesota State Director.
Bless you.
Mr. Ghosh, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First time at this committee. My name is Brian Ghosh. I'm a lawyer, registered lobbyist with the National Rifle Association, here today to testify against House File 4362. This bill purports to set up a gun-free zone on campuses in Minnesota, and there are many examples in our history and in recent history where gun-free zones don't work. Putting up a sign or having a rule restricting firearms keeps the law-abiding citizen disarmed, but it doesn't disarm the bad guys. The bad guys still come on and inflict maximum damage in what they consider to be a gun-free zone. You heard reference to a Virginia Tech shooting in 2007. That started in the dormitory. The bad guy killed two students. He then went to a classroom building, chained the doors shut, and proceeded to kill 30 more people. 17 were wounded, 6 additional wounded jumping out of windows trying to get away from the bad guy. More recent examples, Loyola, Chicago University, South Carolina State University, Old Dominion, all these happened in the last month. Those are all campuses that declare themselves as gun-free zones. They have rules prohibiting guns on campus. State doesn't allow carrying of firearms by students or visitors. Minnesota does. There are no reported incidences or problems in Minnesota with the rule currently as it is. And I would suggest that Minnesota's rule is closer to what other states are doing, or at least a growing trend in the United States. So currently, there are 11 states that specifically allow students to carry firearms on campus. Two recent examples of that would be South Dakota and Wyoming. They have not had any problems since those laws became in effect. There's a 12th state, New Hampshire, that's poised to enact a college campus carry law. It would be the most liberal version of it. It's going to allow 18 to 20-year-olds to carry as well and constitutional carry. It'd be the first state allowing constitutional carry for carrying on campus. There are other states that are permissive. They allow the state or the university to decide if students and others can carry on campus. Since this bill tends to go the opposite direction of what's trendy now in America and for other reasons, I would suggest not supporting House File 4362. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Our next testifier for House File 4362 is Anna Leamy, the Director of Government Relations and Advocacy for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. Ms. Leamy, if you'd please make your way to the testifier table. All right, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Anna Leamy, Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. House File 4362 expands firearm restrictions across large areas of public property by treating university-controlled land as a broad exclusion zone for the exercise of Second Amendment rights. This restriction falls on law-abiding permit holders. Minnesota permit-to-carry holders have already been vetted by the state and entrusted to carry for lawful self-defense. House File 4362 does not target criminals. It disarms the people who comply with the law while doing nothing to deter those who do not. Individuals who are intent on committing crimes do not consult maps of restricted zones before acting. Students, employees, and visitors move through these spaces at all hours, often in areas that are open, unmonitored, and not secured. Denying lawful self-defense in these environments does not enhance safety. It creates vulnerability. Universities are not uniquely sensitive locations where constitutional rights can be broadly restricted. Public universities in Minnesota occupy enormous geographic footprints that include sidewalks, public roads, green space, parking areas, and other open access property used daily by thousands of Minnesotans who are not students, faculty, or staff. These are not controlled environments like courthouses or secure government buildings. Expanding the definition of sensitive places to include entire campuses risks turning vast portions of public land into rights-free zones. House File 4362 also creates due process problems by applying criminal penalties in areas where the boundaries are not clearly defined or readily understood by the public. University property often blends seamlessly into surrounding city streets, sidewalks, and adjacent private property. A lawful permit to carry holder could unknowingly cross onto university-controlled land and face criminal liability without any clear notice. House File 4362 expands firearm restrictions across vast, undefined areas of public land, relies on an unsupported expansion of sensitive places, and imposes criminal penalties on law-abiding Minnesotans who have already been vetted and trained. For these reasons, I respectfully urge you to vote no on House File 4362.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to offer testimony on House File 4362? All right, seeing none, we will now move on to member discussion for House File 4362. Are there any members who would wish to be recognized? I recognize Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Representative Coulter, what's the higher ed budget for this biennium? Rough guess, I would suspect the chair might have that answer.
Vice Chair Coulter.
I would not want to tell tales out of school, so I think I would defer to Mr. Savory on that answer.
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, the general fund and healthcare access fund total budget for the previous higher education omnibus appropriations bill was roughly $4 billion.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. $4 billion, that's the number. I apologize, I would have got that, but my phone was locked up. I had to reboot before I had time to get the question answered. So, Representative Coulter, it's $4 billion. You ask, why do private colleges have this and state colleges don't? In my mind, it's because the state of Minnesota, the taxpayers of Minnesota, are paying $4 billion to these state college systems. I don't own a part of St. Benny's. I don't own a part of St. Thomas. But part of my wife and I's tax bill every year goes to pay for our higher ed system. Going to the questions, how is a visitor supposed to know if they're on campus, if it's a prohibited area? Would you have some areas that are prohibited? I can see like going into a sporting venue, but some aren't. How are you going to handle signage?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Notley, first of all, to your first comment, we do actually subsidize private colleges and universities through the state grant program, as well as other various programs that we offer. To answer your question, I think it would be enforced the same way that it's currently enforced on private property, signage in appropriate areas. As far as what exactly a policy would look like, what buildings or what have you it would cover, that would be up to the individual. Bless you. That would be up, to the individual institution. I will point out that bless you again, goodness. That the bill does limit this to property that is owned by the institution, so it would not cover any other public property or any private property nearby or even within what would be considered a campus.
Representative Novotny.
Chair Wolgamott, bless you, by the way.
Thank you. Hay fever season.
Representative Coulter, what about parking lots? So if a person has a permit to carry and they go to an event and they can't take it into the venue, would they be able to use it in a park? Would they be able to store it in their vehicle in the parking lot?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rodney, if you look at line 1.21 through 1.23 on the bill itself, this does not change that section of statute, so they would not be able to prohibit lawful carry in a parking facility or a parking area.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Representative Coulter, are you familiar with the bill that's in front of the, it's, I don't know where it's at right now, but it is in the House that would change that rule. It's currently about prohibiting from parking lots, just as a thought. you mentioned several incidents that took place and that I think Mr. Gosh covered before I could get to that, but as he mentioned, those were all gun-free zones. I don't know if you watched the news last week, but I believe it was Thursday of last week, might have been the week before, but in one day there were two attacks that appear to be terrorist-related, but a person drove a vehicle into a school, a Jewish school, and security guards were able to confront them. And then the other one on the East Coast, and the name is the college is at a loss for me, where the ROTC students were able to fight back. The only thing they had was a knife, and they were able to defend themselves with a knife and stop that person in that attack. I look at the House here, and we had concerns over safety and security, and what did we do as a group? The House, the Capitol Security Commission, decided that we would have more people that were able to defend themselves and take care of themselves as opposed to disarming. I'm a farm kid. I'll make it really simple. When the wolf attacks, we don't take the teeth and the claws off of the sheepdog that they're to protect them. And with that, I'm going to be a no on this.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Further discussion on House File 4362. I recognize Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Coulter, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I'd like to remind everyone in this room and kind of level set that I believe most of our private colleges are not-for-profits, and they receive a very large subsidy from the state in that we do not collect taxes from them for many things. So that's a huge public subsidy. So I would think possibly, you know, that would be something we should consider going forward whenever we look at anything public or private. I think this is a very good bill because when things happen, when outsiders come onto a college campus and they create havoc and harm, there is a large public expense. There's a massive response that occurs. Ambulances are dispatched. This is all a large public cost. And so whatever we could do to prevent that public cost is not only life-saving, but it's also fiscally responsible. So I think it's a very good bill. And to give the institutions an ability to say, this person doesn't belong here, this person is armed, we need to remove this implement of harm so that we can keep our students safe. That is their fiduciary responsibility to keep the students safe. I think it's a very good bill. It's always interesting to me to hear someone say, you know, these gun-free zones exist and harm still occurs, so let's not have gun-free zones. We require everyone to have car insurance if they're gonna drive a car, right? It's insurance I buy every year hoping to never use. But accidents do happen, harm does happen, right? So we require that. Now, the argument that it is your constitutional right to carry, I hear that, but rights also come with responsibilities. So we're not talking about someone who is behaving in a lawful way, being asked to leave an institution. We're asking that if someone is behaving in an unlawful way or in a dangerous manner, for the institution to have rules in place that would allow that individual to be removed, because rights come with responsibility. And we've heard that over and over in the court cases and in litigation. So I think the bill is right. It's going in the right direction. And I just want to thank you for having the courage to bring it in light of the fact that there are many people who don't want this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Are there any other members who are wishing to provide discussion on House File 4362? Vice Chair Coulter, before I leave it to you for closing remarks, I personally would just like to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I will be requesting a roll call vote, and I will be asking members to vote yes for this. This is already policy for faculty and students, and the more that we can do to ensure that students feel safe, that students are protected. Students have enough on their plates to worry about. They don't need to worry about gun violence threatening their ability to get a higher education. So, again, Vice Chair Coulter, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'll be voting yes. I ask members to also vote yes, and, well, leave it to you for closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I get into my prepared comments, I do want to address this concept of gun-free zones. I saw something written somewhere, I think in one of the letters in our packets, referring to the myth of gun-free zones. And I think my answer to that is that the reverse of that argument is not true. More guns do not make us safe. If that were true, America would be the safest country in the world. And I think we all know that that's not true. I was going to request a roll call, but you beat me to the punch, Mr. Chair. I was 12 years old when Columbine happened. And I think it's hard for those of us who didn't grow up in the shadow of so many school shootings to understand what that feels like. And it's hard for those of us maybe who don't have young kids going into school to understand the feeling in the pit of your stomach when you say goodbye to them every morning. And it's hard to understand, I think, for many, how infuriating it is for students, teachers, and parents when elected officials say nothing can be done and wash their hands of it. An all too appropriate phrase, I think, as we approach Holy Week, considering that it came from an official who chose cowardice and political expediency over justice. Our students, our learners, and all of the people who make that learning happen deserve to have a say in how they are protected from gun violence. And they deserve to know if their leaders' higher loyalty is to their lives or to the guns. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Coulter. The clerk will take the roll on House File 4362.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll begin with Chair Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Chair Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Vice Chair Coulter?
Aye.
Coulter, aye. Vice Chair Schwartz?
No.
Schwartz, no. Representative Allen?
No.
Allen, no. Representative Duran?
Oh.
Duran, no. Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Hansen, yes. Representative Hicks?
Aye.
Hicks, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, yes.
Noor, yes. Representative Novotny?
No.
Novotny, no. Representative Rarick. Representative Rarick here today on Zoom?
Rarick, no.
Rarick, no. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Mr. Chair, the count is 7-7.
There being 7 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail, and House File 4362 will not be referred to the Public Safety Committee. All right, members, the next bill on our agenda for today is House File 4252, which is the Governor's Higher Education Policy Bill. I want to make clear to both the members of this committee and the members of the public that my intention in bringing this bill forward was not to move it out of this committee, is not to make any changes to the bill at this time, but is simply to give the Office of Higher Education and the governor's team the opportunity to present their bill, get it on the record, have a discussion on it, and have members of the public be able to come forward and testify either for or against the proposals that are in the bill. Again, that's why we will not be moving this bill. We will be laying it over for future discussion. We just want to get the information and have the conversation today. So with that, I'm going to move that House File 4252 be laid over. And I'm also going to move the, I have an A1 author's amendment, which is some, includes some technical changes that were brought forward by the Office of Higher Education. And if they would please, the OHE team would make their way to the testifier table. While I explain that I know that we have a number of amendments to the A1 amendment, but before we get into those amendments to the A1 amendment, we want to give OHE the opportunity to present their recommendations to the bill as amended in full. Then after that, we will, after OHE has the opportunity to make its presentation, we will go through all of the amendments to the A1 amendment, and then we will vote on the A1 amendment. All right, that is our roadmap for today. And with that, I will would like to extend a very warm welcome to Commissioner Dennis Olson. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I'm proud to serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Here at the table with me is, well, I can let you introduce yourself, I guess, but Nikki Oliver, our Director of Government Relations. And Chair, based on your comments here, I'm going to hand it over to Nikki to walk through some of the provisions. I will then, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, have some comments, and then we'll turn it over to our colleagues, primarily Nicole Whalen, our manager of State Grant Research.
Ms. Oliver, welcome back to the Higher Education Committee. We always appreciate having you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Nikki Oliver, Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Office of Higher Education. And Mr. Chair, just some clarification. Do you want me to talk to the current bill or the amendment first?
If you would speak to the current bill and then just make sure to include what changes are made with the A1. So we want to just get a comprehensive sweep of what is the bill that you're bringing forward, but just include it as amended, because that's ultimately what we'll be voting on. But if you could just clarify what the A1 amendment does while you do that, we would appreciate it. Ms. Oliver.
Yeah. So I'll walk through the bill as it's currently written. The A1 amendment is actually policy that was included in the governor's budget recommendation, but they're actually policy items, so that's why we're asking for this to be amended into the policy bill. And then, like the commissioner mentioned, he and Nicole Whalen will talk more about the state grant recommendation portion of the governor's recs. So first, the bill as it's currently written, I'll just talk specifically about what the changes are, not in too much detail about what we're doing in this bill. One of the things we're doing in this bill, we're cleaning up references to reporting. Last year and 2023 and 2024, we created some consolidating reporting for student financial aid. What we're doing in this bill is we're changing and cleaning up the language so that it's of removing things that are no longer applicable to this consolidation reporting. Another thing we're doing here, as you all may recall, there was the passage of protections for pregnant and parenting students, which aligned with federal policies. We're making some modifications here. When we added the private institutions, there was a misdrafting where we didn't update the definitions for students. So that's being clarified in here. And then also a few private institutions and even publics wanted more clarity around what responsibilities the institutions have when it comes to granting leave for parents. So we're adding that in the bill as well per request. We're also repealing redundant reporting requirements for concurrent enrollment grants. As you all may recall, that program was repealed. And then also we're updating within our various financial aid statutes. There's different ways the terms resident and reside and residency. So we're updating that so they're more consistent. So that is the current bill. And then I can also speak to the amendment. So in the amendment, we're amending outdated work study statutes. We're cleaning up several parts of 136A.233 that do not reflect actual practice. A disabled or person over 65 is an employer prioritizing based on enrollment level employment outside the institution and percent awarded to graduate students. There are also the bulk of this amendment are modifications to the licensing and registration statute, and we do have Andrew Wald here who can speak more to questions regarding that. I feel like four of the five amendments are related to that those sections. What we're doing is amending the Private and Out-of-State Public Post-Secondary Education Act within our statutes and the Private Career Schools Act to make certain policy changes and amend language to reduce burden and eliminate content-based regulations in accordance with determinations from the court. So we're making changes as it relates to litigation and recommendations from the judge. We also have some 529 plan conformity. We have language that deals with dormant accounts and uncashed checks. And then also related to that program, we're updating the statute to allow for the office to share with plant account owners information and resources that are available within the office, i.e. the self-loan program. We also have a small modification to the dual training grants policy. We amend the dual training grant statute to allow otherwise eligible accredited bachelor's degree or higher programs to not have to be instructor-led for most of the training. This change benefits occupations like nursing, early childhood education, and other fields where accredited programs are often offered fully online and asynchronously. But by allowing accredited asynchronous programs to qualify for dual training grant funding, employers gain more flexibility, flexible training options that better match their workforce needs, and employees can advance their skills and credentials while maintaining work schedules. This was also a request by the employers and the Department of Labor and Industry. Lastly, we are, as it relates to fraud, strengthening our student financial aid protections by adding language to our statutes preventing someone who has misused or defrauded a state financial aid program access to other financial aid programs under 136A. We currently have language similar to this for federal fraud or misuse, that if you are found guilty of fraud or misuse in a federal program, you cannot access our state program. So we want to do the same for our state programs. That is the gist of the amendment and also the bill.
Members, before we begin to, we also have one more testifier. I'd like to welcome to the table Nicole Whalen.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, my colleague Nicole is getting set up here. I'll just offer a few brief comments, maybe just set the table a little bit.
Thank you, again, Commissioner Olson. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, extend my appreciation to the committee and, of course, Chair Wolgamott for agreeing to hear these recommendations here and have an opportunity to react to those included in the amendments as well. Just, you know, before we start discussing the recommendations for a state grant, just want to, you know, come before the committee and acknowledge, you know, what a difficult kind of situation this is. Again, you know, everyone was around last year when we were talking about pressures on the state grant program as well. And, you know, we are before the committee again talking about both renewed and new pressures on the state grant as well as just state financial aid overall. You know, I did appreciate the flexibility and do appreciate the flexibility that we had this year, year one of the biennium, to be able to take the time during the summer and early fall to, you know, actually survey and engage our financial aid and campus partners about the best path forward. As you know, with limited options available to us, we're still able to come to a mutually agreeable decision based on feedback from our financial aid and campus partner community, you know, to ensure at least the least disruption for students this year in their state grant awards. We issued rationing parameters to keep campuses, you know, essentially consistent and predictable in terms of being able to package their awards. But those rationing parameters, as you well know, will go into effect now next year, this upcoming school year. So in developing the proposals in front of you here for consideration, you know, we recognize that not everyone will agree with them, potentially not everyone will be happy with, you know, the ultimate outcome, but, you know, students will experience some level of reduction in their awards without additional resources added to the program. But really the overall goal of the recommendations is just to address what, you know, we're now considering really a structural deficit within the state grant program. And so we know that there will be continued discussions. You know, we appreciate the committee's commitment to making sure that, again, we can come to something that, you know, we all agree is the best path forward in terms of funding the state grant program and making awards for students as beneficial as possible. So I want to walk just through two key changes. You know, I want to say, though, that just to frame it again, it's important to note we're here because more Minnesotans are enrolling in college year over year. You know, we've now consistently seen that, and we've noted that that's a positive trend for the state. I mean, it really is. But again, it does bring some continued and new renewed pressures on the state grant and state financial aid programs. You know, we've had enrollment come in higher than projected numbers that have been reported to us, tuition and fee rates that have exceeded projected rates that have been reported to us. And we, of course, have more students applying for and becoming eligible for financial aid through filing of the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. I just looked it up this morning, and there's about a week data lag, but according to NCAN, the National College Attainment Network, they track almost in real time FAFSA filing rates. FAFSA completions nationally have increased 20.9% compared to the class of 2025 through this same date last year. And if you look at the class of 2023, it's up nearly 12%. And so it seems like we're continually discussing pressures on state financial aid resources, but it is important to note. I just want the committee to know that this is not unique to Minnesota. You know, similar pressures as a result of the implementation of the new FAFSA Simplification Act at the federal level are putting similar pressures on state financial aid resources across multiple states throughout the country, as well as even the federal government themselves. You know, we briefly mentioned it just really quick. I know it's, you know, it didn't get a lot of discussion, but I want to bring attention again to the committee, the pressures that even the federal government themselves are facing with the Pell Grant program. Just at the end of February, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, issued a report, you know, showing that the Pell Grant itself is facing in fiscal 26 a $5.5 billion shortfall. And, you know, if no action is taken, if no additional resources are added, that even balloons to over $11 billion in fiscal 27 and over $100 billion within 10 years. And so, you know, the federal government themselves, although they've infused last year $10.5 billion in an effort to kind of shore up and close up the shortfall, they themselves now are facing an additional shortfall, which could potentially mean without additional resources, you know, smaller Pell Grants. And, you know, it's a result of kind of flat funding or not continuing to increase funding and even changes in eligibility. Those students that are currently eligible may no longer be eligible. So, all that to say, you know, this is not unique to Minnesota. We feel we have some ideas here to potentially address the shortfall, but again, open to plenty of discussion with not only the committee, but all of our partners as well to come to a resolution. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to turn it over to Nicole Whalen.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Olson. Ms. Whalen, please introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Whalen, and I am the Financial Aid Research Manager for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I believe we have a presentation that we're trying to get online. Give us a moment.
Well, unfortunately, it seems that we're having some technical difficulties, and so in the interest of time for members, I think we're going to continue trying to get your presentation online, but out of respect for members' time and for hoping to get through this information, if we could all just listen extra intently to the presentation, if you could deliver that to us verbally, we would appreciate it. Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am happy to do so. And some of this may be review for some folks, so it'll seem like a little bit that you may have seen in prior presentations anyways. So hopefully not too hard to follow along. So just to kick us off, a little bit of, again, some overview of the state grant program. So Minnesota State Grant Program is our state's largest financial need program. It serves just under 76,000 students last year. Over 80 institutions participate in the state grant program. It has an annual budget of $247 million and an average award of just under $3,000. With 57% of recipients having family adjusted gross incomes of less than $40,000. And overall, we see the vast majority of recipients do attend our public institutions in the state. I had a very lovely visual representation of how a state grant award is calculated that I'm sure you all would find very helpful since it is a complicated award formula, so we will be happy to share that after the meeting. But essentially how a state grant award is calculated is we first set a budget for the student. That budget is comprised of the living and miscellaneous expense allowance as well as tuition and fees, with tuition and fees being capped at the maximum in law. After that, we calculate an assigned student responsibility, or ASR, which is set at 50% of the budget in law. And then we subtract the assigned family responsibility. And that number is derived ultimately from the FAFSA, but modified as well according to state statute. Then we subtract the student's Pell Grant, and anything left over is a state grant. The award is also prorated by based on enrollment level. So if the student is not full-time, they will receive a grant that corresponds with their enrollment level. We do run projections on the program twice a year in February and November. We perform those projections based on internal data derived from our systems that looks at the prior year's state grant applicant files. So that is, for fiscal year 2025, that's about 131,000 students that filed FAFSA and met eligibility requirements for the state grant program. We take that file and we essentially run a full simulation of their state grant award adding in additional information that's provided by our institutions, such as changes in tuition and fees and changes in enrollment. And we use that to come up with an estimate of what state grant spending will look like into the next biennium. These projections can change due to a variety of factors that are outside of our agency's control. Obviously, the number one is, I would say, enrollment changes. So as enrollment increases, state grant spending increases. And although our institutions try to project those numbers as well as they possibly can, those numbers can fluctuate dramatically year to year. Additionally, tuition and fee increases will, if tuition and fees come in higher than projected, that will increase spending for the program, and vice versa. And then FAFSA formula changes have a huge impact on our state grant program. And we had a very major FAFSA formula change in 2025. So we're now finally have a full year's worth of data to look at following the federal FAFSA change. And now that we have that information, we're able to more accurately project into future years what state grant spending will look like. Let's see, so I also have just some background information on the state grant deficit that is projected. You know, earlier when we were here, I presented information that showed that with rationing that the agency had put into place, we have closed that deficit and left an $8 million projected balance in the program at the end of the biennium. However, I also have included some numbers that show what the projected deficit would have been had we not engaged in rationing, and that is roughly $131 million. The $8 million balance that we have left in the program at the end of the biennium is less than 2% of total resources, so that still is a very tight margin for the program. Additionally, when the state grant program runs a deficit and changes are made in that program, there's a reciprocal impact on the North Star Promise program. Because the state grant awards were rationed for next year, we did increase spending in the North Star Promise program significantly. So as a result, our agency has used our statutory authority to limit the amount and or size of awards made in the North Star Promise program to institute a priority deadline of June 1st, 2026 for students to receive funding under North Star Promise. And we made this decision based on prior year applicant behavior, feeling that we should comfortably be able to fund applicants to the program through that date. As Commissioner Olson noted, the state grant program has been seeing a higher reported enrollment from our institutions, but the percent increase in state grant applicants year over year has actually vastly exceeded that of has vastly exceeded enrollment trends, where we're seeing in some cases twice as many or three times as many the increase in state grant applicants year over year as we are enrollment. And that to me is saying that students are filing the FAFSA at higher rates. If we look year over year, enrollment has increased. Last year, fiscal year 2025, we had a year over year increase in enrollment of almost 5%. That's from 23 to 2025, that was a nearly 10 percentage point increase in year to year enrollment growth. In 2023, we had a 5% decline in enrollment. So in my mind, that is the equivalent of flipping a light switch in an empty home and having every light in the house turn on all at once. And I'm sure our campus partners have experienced that to a much greater extent than our agency has. So last year was the largest single year enrollment increase since 2010. And then additionally, last year, 2025, we did notice a bump in Minnesota undergraduate students applying for state grants. And that was a 12 percentage point increase from the prior year. So that is, again, like a very big bump. Previously, around 55 to 60% of Minnesota undergraduates applied for the state grant program, and last year that number was 66%. We've also additionally heard from campuses that fall to spring and year-to-year retention was higher than it has been in the past. So typically, higher education is what we consider countercyclical. What that means is that when the economy tends to take a tumble, we see enrollment and thus spending in higher education increase. That is something this program has seen before. However, based on the enrollment and FAFSA filing patterns that we are seeing right now, I do believe that we are experiencing, yes, a bit of a cyclical, countercyclical increase, but also there's an added layer to that, and that is the changes to the federal needs analysis that happened in 2025. So with the change to the FAFSA form, we see now that more than a third of state grant applicants had a $0 or negative student aid index in 2025, whereas that proportion was significantly lower in 2024. We saw 43% of applicants with a $0 or less contribution in 2025 and 29% of applicants with a $0 contribution in 2024. So that's a big increase. And not only do we see a larger proportion of students who have actually negative SAIs, but the entire distribution of need for the program has shifted. So for students in our primary income range of state grant eligibility, that entire distribution has shifted left. So what that means from a practical perspective is that almost all state grant eligible students saw some sort of decrease in their family contribution with the new FAFSA form, and that in turn increases their state grant awards. So this represents overall a baseline shift in need, not just a 1 to 2 year dip in the economy, making it highly likely that we could continue to see projected deficits for the program in future years. Overall, I would say that the state grant formula is incredibly complex with a variety of levers that can be pulled to alter spending in the program. So one of the changes that the governor is proposing is to set negative SAIs to $0 when calculating state financial aid. This change reduces state grant spending by about $37 million when compared to unrationed state grant spending. The change change reduces the deficit to just a little under $100 million. Additional cuts would be needed to bring the program program spending in line with ongoing appropriations. The other change that was proposed was setting a tuition and fee maximum equivalent to the average tuition and fees at four-year public institutions, including the University of Minnesota system. This change would bring spending down by another $40 million. The program would still need to be rationed in fiscal year 2027, but it will be much closer to operating within ongoing appropriations in future years. The North Star Promise program, which will still require a priority deadline for fiscal year 2027, would likely have that deadline move forward to July 1st of fiscal year 2027 as opposed to June 1st. But this change overall will lessen the strain on the North Star Promise program in future years. And overall, OHE is committed to engaging with stakeholders on what changes to the state grant program may look like in the next biennium. So happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Whalen. Are there any, let's see, before we go on to member questions, I am going to open it up if there are any members of the public who are wishing to testify on House File 4252. All right, please proceed to the testifier table. Okay, any other members of the public? Seeing none, we will proceed to member questions on the this bill with the A1 amendment as presented, and then we will proceed to the amendments to the A1 amendment. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Ms. Whalen. So you had said that if we change the cap on tuition and fees, that we would see a savings to the state grant program of $40 million. Can you tell me what that change exactly would be? So what is the new cap?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Rarick. That number is an estimated $14,721 in fiscal year 2027. We do not have actual enrollment, or excuse me, actual tuition and fee information from the systems at this point in time, but based on estimates that were provided to our office this year, that is what the estimated tuition and fees would look like.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so that's equivalent to which institution? Because typically we cap it of the four-year institution. I believe it was with the highest, which would be the University of Minnesota. So can you tell me in relation to the University of Minnesota's tuition what the change would be?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick. That number is an average of all four-year public institutions. So that would include the Minnesota State University system as well as the University of Minnesota system. In relation to tuition and fees at the University of Minnesota, it's roughly $4,000 lower than the University of Minnesota is projected to have in fiscal year 27. I believe that number is lower than most campuses in the University of Minnesota system, with, I believe, one exception, and I could get back to you on the specifics of that.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Ms. Whalen. We had talked about this more in relation to a 2% cap. So in other words, if the University of Minnesota raised their tuition more than 2%, then the state grant would not cover that additional amount. Now, that didn't stop them from raising their tuition. They did it anyway, didn't they? Anyway, okay, so that's one aspect of it. You also talked about North Star Promise. And I was writing all that down, and it sounds like we're also increasing the pressure to North Star Promise tremendously. And I think I missed exactly what would be the additional pressure. Do you have a dollar amount of what you think the new pressure would be? And I'm sure we'll run out of money there as well. So you had talked about rationing. Could you tell me, so if we don't ration, what would be the hole in North Star Promise?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick. If we were not to ration North Star Promise, taking into account both of these changes that the governor has proposed, the hole in that program... No, I apologize. I would have to get back to you with the specifics on that number. I believe it is roughly $40 million, more or less.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, and help me remember what the total appropriation for the biennium was for North Star Promise, and is that $40 million for the last fiscal year of the biennium?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The total biennial appropriation for North Star Promise is $99 million for the biennium, and that $40 million hole would be only in the second year of the biennium, fiscal year 2027.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this. Just trying to understand the fiscal mess that we find ourselves in. I believe I heard in the testimony that we actually have $131 million shortfall in the state grant program had we not rationed. And so it looks like a $40 million shortfall in the state grant, in North Star Promise if we didn't ration, out of literally a biennial appropriation of $99 million. So that's a pretty massive structural imbalance, I would say. You know, I am absolutely in support of going from a 1500 SAI to a negative, or moving it from the negative to a zero SAI. It sounds like that's a $37 million savings. I'm very much in support of that. I want to learn a little bit more about changing the tuition and fee max that would save us $40 million in the state grant program. But it's still, we still have a massive hole, members. We have an absolutely massive hole that we've created in both North Star Promise and the state grant program. And I don't think we're going to get out of it with just changing some levers. We're going to have to really buckle down and figure out how to change the structural imbalance. And I appreciate the governor's recommendations. I really do. Those are two levers that we could pull and kind of change it back to the way things had been. Not recognizing the negative 1500 SAI would bring us a little ways towards, you know, closing this gap, but the gap is even bigger than I had imagined, because now we've borrowed from the second year of the biennium to put it into the first year of the biennium, so now we have a massive hole in the second year of the biennium. We've got quite a mess. And, you know, last session, we tried really hard to look at every single program within our $4 billion budget, as Representative Novotny pointed out, and we looked at anything and everything that we could possibly cut, a program that was maybe not as effective, that wasn't as relevant anymore. And we, you know, we made some changes and we made some strides, but we are still facing a massive hole. And, you know, I have no idea if we're going to get any additional appropriations. So I'm not sure how we're going to get ourselves out of this hole, members. You know, we've got a few amendments, Mr. Chair. I don't know that they're necessarily important to bring up today, as you are just going to lay this bill over. We can certainly talk briefly about them, but overarching, we just wanted to know very simply some of the changes. We wanted to hear their testimony, particularly about some of the private schools, the for-profit schools. There seem to be quite a few changes there, but I actually have a couple of amendments I would still like to see in addition to these. So I'm glad we're laying this over today, because I still have outstanding concerns as we move forward. So anyway, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me the time, and I'll turn it back to you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. And yes, as was mentioned earlier, the goal here was not to pass this out of the committee, but just to give the Office of Higher Education and the governor's team the opportunity to present their recommendations and take questions on it. So we'll move on to one more member question, and then we will dive into those amendments. Vice Chair Colter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This should be quick because Representative Rarick, great minds think alike, and she asked almost all of the questions that I was going to ask right off the bat. I did just have one question for Ms. Whalen, though. The tuition average in the recommendations, you spoke kind of quickly, and I think I didn't hear you. That's an average of all four-year colleges and universities, correct?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an average of all four-year public universities, so the Minnesota State University system as well as the University of Minnesota system.
Vice Chair Colter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That I just wanted to make sure I understood that it is all four-year public colleges and universities, not an average that would include two-year colleges in any way. So thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood that. Thank you.
All right, we've got one more member question. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just was wondering, since we couldn't see your presentation, maybe you had some of this, but when you present these different options to us, it would be so helpful if we could sort of see it broken out by the impact on students at different income levels. And I'm even thinking, because of the interaction with the North Star Promise program, maybe, you know, if we can somehow sort of see that combined with those two programs together, how, because when I hear, you know, the governor's proposal and about, you know, changing that SAI, is that the term? So we're basically saying the students at the lowest level, we're just going to pretend you're not at that lowest level for purposes of this. And that, you know, we could pretend that number's on a sheet, but that's going to impact those lowest income students the most. And I just would really like us if we go that kind of route, to be really cognizant of who's getting hit the worst. For some students, it may just mean they can't go to college. For other students, it may mean that they have to work a little more. So I want us to have the full scope of that. Thanks.
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have that information. It would make most sense if I get that to you separately. It is a very large spreadsheet that is not distilled for a PowerPoint, but I do have all that information broken up.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Anything further, Representative Liebling? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I was having a similar thought about the questions, Chair Liebling. So if you could make that available to all the committee members, we would greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. And with that, we are going to move on to amendments to the A1 author's amendment. The first amendment that we will bring up is labeled the A3 amendment. Who is offering this A3 amendment? All right.
That'd be me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Allen. Would you please briefly tell us what the A3 amendment does?
So the idea of this amendment would delete Section 54 of the bill, which means the language on the lines, on lines 30.5 through 30.9 that removes the program exemptions would no longer be repealed and remain in law. This section of the bill eliminates the existing exemption for programs focused on personal development, recreation, remedial education, adult basic education, and the exercise or fitness instructor training, modeling, or acting. The underlying bill removes these exemptions, which means more programs in these areas would become subject to private career school licensure requirements and regulations by OHE. That's a significant shift because these programs have been treated differently from traditional career training programs, and they have been allowed to operate without going through the private career school licensing process. Members, this amendment keeps the current exemption framework in place. The intent here is to maintain the existing structure in law where these types of programs aren't treated as the same as traditional private career schools. Many of these programs are short-term, personal enrichment, recreational, or non-degree programs. And the legislature has historically decided that they shouldn't be subject to the same regulations as career training institutions that are, that prepare students for specific occupations. By keeping these exemptions in place, the amendment preserves the distinction between career training programs and personal enrichment or recreational programs. It also gives the legislature more time to effectively evaluate if removing these exemptions is the right policy decision. Because of eliminating the exemptions would expand OHE's regulatory authority into these areas that haven't been regulated as private career schools. But at this moment, I'm going to be withdrawing my amendment, and I look forward to having conversations with OHE specifically around this issue, and I hope we're able to address it later on. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allen. The next amendment before us is labeled A5. Who is bringing forward the A5 amendment?
It'd be me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Duran, please briefly explain the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A5 amendment is a technical amendment. On page 14, the amendment changes the word must back to may and restores discretion to OHE rather than creating a mandatory requirement. The concern with this must language is that it removes the flexibility of and forces OHE to take specific actions in every circumstance, regardless of funding levels, program demands, or administrative capacity. By changing the language back to me, this amendment allows the office to implement the provision when appropriate, but not require it in a situation where it's not workable or resources are limited. This amendment doesn't eliminate the authority in the bill and doesn't change the overall policy goal. It simply makes the provision permissive instead of mandatory, which is more appropriate when we're dealing with program administrations and implementation decisions that vary year to year. So again, this is a technical change, restoring administrative flexibility while keeping the underlying policy in place. We look forward to Mr. Chair, at this time, I will be withdrawing this amendment as well. We look forward to continuing discussions with OHI on this issue as well. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Duran. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt the flow here, but I'm a little confused. Are we adopting the A1? And if so, should we have adopted that already and then we present ours as amendments to the amendments? Like, I feel like we're confused. So we're still on the A1 and we're presenting amendments to the A1, but
That's
A1 has not been adopted.
Correct. The A1 has not been adopted. We are hearing the amendments to the A1 amendment.
Okay.
Before voting on adopting the A1 amendment, whether or not it is or isn't amended.
Thank you. Appreciate the clarification.
I would just add, like, that's how we do it on the House floor. We bring forward an amendment. Then we bring forward the amendments to the amendment. We see whether or not the amendment gets amended, and then we vote on the underlying amendment, whether or not it's amended. All right, speaking of amendments. Speaking of amendments, there's another amendment at the desk. We have an amendment labeled. All right, members, all right. I know we all love amendments, let's hone it in. All right, speaking of amendments, we have another amendment at the desk. The amendment is labeled A7. Who is bringing forward the A7 amendment?
That would be me, Chair Wilgamont.
All righty. Representative Novotny is offering the A7 amendment. Representative Novotny, please explain the A7 amendment.
The A7 amendment deletes Section 16. The reason for this amendment is Section 16 removes several longstanding work-study provisions. We believe those provisions should remain in law unless there's a clear reason to remove them. The language that removes includes language that requires school to give priority to work study jobs for students who take less than 12 credits. Excuse me. Requires schools to make reasonable efforts to place students with off-campus employers, prohibit public employees from using work study programs to replace permanent employees, limit how much of the school's work-study allocation can go to graduate students, and allow up to 30% of the funds to be used for internships with private for-profit employees. These are long-standing guardrails that ensure a program is focused on undergraduate students, provides workforce experience, and doesn't unintentionally displace permanent workers. So the intent of the A7 amendment is to remove Section 16 from the amendment so that this language stays in as for now. OHE can explain why they're proposing to remove these provisions. I would hope at some point we can have that conversation, Chair Wilgamont, but at this point I will withdraw my amendment.
Representative Novotny has withdrawn the A7 amendment. There is another amendment at the desk labeled A4. Who will be offering the A4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, it's mine.
All righty. Representative Robbins is offering the A4 amendment. Representative Robbins, would you please briefly explain the A4 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we're withdrawing the amendments, but I would like to hear feedback from OHI as we go through. So maybe we can step back on that. And so I don't know if they wanted to speak to the ones that have already been brought up, and then we can proceed with the A4. I'm happy to do the A4, and you can reply to all of them at the end, however you would like. But I, like, this is a genuine conversation. I was sort of surprised that we didn't get a briefing on your proposal before committee today. Normally we do, and we kind of walk through it, and so to have this conversation now, that's why we brought the amendments, to try and generate a discussion of why are you doing these really significant policy changes. So, however you want to proceed, I'm happy to present the amendment and they can respond, or they can respond to the other ones first.
Representative Robbins, thank you for bringing this forward. I first want to say that the commissioner and the team at OHI did do a very good job of reaching out. They reached out to me and looped me in, and then we made the decision that we could have a group discussion, you know, with this committee. That's why I'm bringing this forward, and I appreciate the outreach from the commissioner and the team at OHI. and for being here today to have this conversation with us. Representative Robbins, you can bring forward the A4 amendment, and then I guess if the team at OHE would like to speak to your amendment specifically, we can get through your amendment, we can get through the A6 amendment, and then if the team at OHE has any additional thoughts or comments or things about any of the amendments that have been brought forward and withdrawn. We haven't really been having discussion because the amendments are getting withdrawn as soon as they're being presented. But if when you have the floor and you're presenting your amendment, you have the opportunity to ask those at the testifier table further feedback and input. So we'll do that for your amendment out of courtesy to you, Representative Robbins. We'll proceed with the A6. We'll give OHE the opportunity to weigh in on all this conversation that we've been having to the A1 amendment, and then we will vote on the A1 amendment. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm a little bit concerned with how this is going. If this is going to be a conversation, then each amendment should have a response from OHE. We brought these amendments so that we could hear what OHE's answer was to why they put these policy pieces together. I heard something about litigation, about the privates, although I didn't hear any detail about that, and a couple of our amendments do directly relate to the private colleges, the for-profit colleges. There is a significant change at what Representative Botany talked about to the work-study program. It's basically gutting the work-study program. These are significant changes that we've not had a conversation about. And Mr. Chair, I would urge a conversation about each of our amendments with OHE so we can hear what their response is. And since we didn't have that meeting in advance, which has always happened in all the years I've been here, where OHE comes in and we have a conversation about what they would like to do. And you know, I recognize that I'm not in person, but Chair Robbins is there and could have easily had that conversation, and that conversation did not happen. So this is it's a little bit backwards. And so I would like to revert back to conversation, Mr. Chair, going back to the First Amendment and finding out what OHE's, what is their intention, because we're basically removing pieces that we have questions about and concerns about that are in the OHE policy bill, and I'd like to hear the response. And this is going to be really important, as you said, since you didn't want to have a conversation, small conversation, you wanted a big conversation. Here we are, and we'd like to have that conversation, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick, I deeply appreciate your input on this. I would like to explain my reasoning for how I've been conducting this hearing. Typically, it is our custom and procedure to have one question or one motion before us. I've been bringing up each of these amendments, and the question before our committee has been that amendment. When a member has withdrawn their amendment, that ends that amendment being before us, and we can't discuss something that is not before us. These are not my amendments that I brought forward. I've had no control over the action that's been taken on any of these amendments. So we have not been able to have a discussion on the question before us, as the authors of the amendment have been withdrawing them after speaking to them. However, Representative Rarick, like I mentioned before, as a courtesy and for the purpose of this hearing, I'm going through each of these amendments. We will have the opportunity for the team at OHE to react and provide their feedback on all these amendments. With that, Representative Robbins, if you would please explain the A4 amendment, and then as the author of the amendment, if you would like for OHE to react to your amendment while you are presenting your amendment, I will give you the floor and you can ask for their reaction. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so the A4 modifies the repealer in Section 61 by reinserting language on lines 31.21 through 31.7 that are deleted in the bill. This is part of the repealer that eliminates Minnesota Statute Section 136A.657, which creates the religious exemption for post-secondary institutions, as well as multiple divisions of Section 136A.834 that define the exemptions from private career school licensure. The underlying bill repeals the framework that allows religious institutions and other exempt entities to operate outside of the private career school licensure structure. By removing those statutes, the bill eliminates the existing exemption framework and brings those institutions under OHE's regulatory authority. This amendment basically keeps the current exemptions in place. The intent here isn't to say that the exemption should never be reviewed or updated, but repealing the entire religious exemption statute and multiple private career school exemption provisions is an enormous policy change. Those exemptions have existed in law for a long time and were created to recognize that certain types of institutions operate under a different educational model and haven't been regulated in the same way. By reinserting this language and preventing those statutes from being repealed, my amendment preserves the current exemption structure and gives the legislature more time to evaluate if eliminating those exemptions is perhaps the right decision. The goal is to avoid eliminating the entire exemption framework without full discussion about what happens to those institutions if the exemptions are removed, or if they would be required to become licensed, how that would impact religious institutions and other exempt providers, and if OHE has the capacity to regulate those institutions if the exemptions disappear. So, Mr. Chair, that's a fairly detailed description, but I would love OHE's thoughts on this. Again, members, we're looking at lines 31.21 through 31.27.
Thank you very much, Representative Robbins. If whomever would, at the testifier table would like to offer a reaction, please state your name and proceed at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, my name is Andrew Wold. I am General Counsel and Director of Compliance at the Office of Higher Education. I oversee our Institutional Licensing and Registration Unit, and the Post-Secondary Education Act and the Private Career School Act are both managed by that unit. We're proposing these changes in the direct response to litigation. The Armstrong Equine Massage Mox case versus Commissioner Olson came to a decision last fall. The federal court stated that these regulations, it was an as-applied challenge rather than a challenge to the entire statute, meaning that we were not able to, the court's determination that we were regulating a First Amendment free speech on a content basis would not apply this statute to our Armstrong Equine Massage. That said, even though it's an as-applied challenge, there's binding authority on the rest of the statute. And so the court's basis for that was that all content-based regulation is subject to strict scrutiny. There is not a compelling state interest in consumer protections, as far as the court is concerned, around student protections and consumer protections for these laws. And so in order to remove the content basis, we have to remove all content bases from the statutes. That includes avocational exemptions, that includes religious exemptions, because those are exemptions that are based on the what they teach, not the how they teach or the fact that they teach. These exemptions, for instance, the religious exemption, because that's what the amendment is discussing right now, are for the institutions to be able to teach how to manage a K-12 parochial school, how to become a priest, imam, or rabbi, how to become, how to just further your own religious studies. If those programs are regulated or exempt from regulation based on the content of what the course is, then that is the speech of the teacher, and we cannot regulate or exempt an institution or a program based on what the person is teaching. So that said, that's the entire rationale for removing these exemptions. And it is a direct response to federal court determination.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I would love for you to send me that court decision, and I would love to have a further discussion about this, because it seems like this is taking a sledgehammer to a fairly narrow situation. And before we would ever support this recommendation, we would want to, look at it very carefully. Thank you.
Representative Robbins, are you withdrawing the A4 amendment or proceeding with its motion?
I'm not sure if anyone else has any questions. Otherwise, I'm happy to withdraw.
Okay.
Okay.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Robbins has withdrawn the A4 amendment. At this time, before bringing up the final amendment, the A6 amendment, out of respect for the request that has been made, we are going to revert back to the A3 amendment that was offered by Representative Allen, which, if I may paraphrase, Representative Allen reinstates the 40-clock-hour exemption from the private school statute. And at this time, I would ask that the team from OHE respond to Representative Allen's A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Allen. This is, for similar reason, being stricken as an exemption in a direct response to the Armstrong Equine Massage case. And if you recall, last session we did add the fitness teacher training to this because we were hoping to expand it and create more efficiencies within the unit. However, that is subject to content basis regulation or exemption. And so thereby we would be treating some institutions differently than we are treating these exempt institutions by making more requirements on those other institutions that do not fall under this exemption based on the content of what is being taught. And so because it's a content-based exemption, it does not withstand, it would put the regulation at the subject of strict scrutiny. The court does not believe that this statute and that there is any compelling state interest in order to support a strict scrutiny standard, and the entire statute would fail if we did not remove this. So we removed all content-based regulation and exemptions and are proceeding with content-neutral exemptions, which currently exist in 40 or fewer clock hours and tuition and fees of not to exceed $500, both of which are content-neutral.
Representative Allen.
I guess I would like to thank you, Chair Wolgamont. I would like to echo Representative Robbins' request as well, that it would be nice to have a little bit more information on this specifically. So thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to further understand the issue that the court was raising, it wasn't that you were treating them different based on content. It was that standard requires strict scrutiny, and the court didn't think that was applicable in this case.
Mr. Wald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins. So because it is a First Amendment issue and it is free speech, then if it is content-based regulation, it is subject to strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny requires a compelling state interest and a narrow tailoring. This regulation, the court's opinion was that this regulation does not meet that standard. If it is a content-neutral regulation, then it would be, then the level of scrutiny would be intermediate scrutiny, which is a lower standard. After discussions with the Attorney General's office, we believe that after making these changes, we would be able to meet intermediate scrutiny standard. And please don't ask me what the entire explanation on intermediate scrutiny is. It brings me back to con law, and I might have some PTSD.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So did the court direct this in their opinion? Or, yeah, tell me what did the court direct you to do?
Mr. Wald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins. The court did not direct this in its determination. This was an as-applied challenge, which means that this statute is being interpreted by the court only as applied to Armstrong Equine Massage. However, the dicta in the decision states all of the reasons why this statute would fail a strict scrutiny standard. So could we wait for another challenge to this statute in whole? Sure. Might that cost the state upwards of $500,000 or more in litigation costs? Yes. And would we win? I think it highly unlikely based on the dicta of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Robbins.
That's enough. Thank you.
Further discussion on the A3 amendment, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the net effect if we remove these parts from statute based on the litigation and the Armstrong case? So if we take those out, how are those entities then being regulated, or are they not? Like, can you just explain what the net effect of it is?
Mr. Wald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick, the net effect would be that, yes, additional institutions would be subject to regulation. I believe that under the Minnesota Private and Out-of-State Public Post-Secondary Education Act, there would be 13 institutions that would be subject to regulation by the removal of 136A.657 religious exemption. There would be, I guess I don't know the number, I think it's fewer with regard to 136A.834 on licensed schools. However, removing subdivision 1 from 136A.833, which is the avocational exemption, there would be more, and many of those would be the yoga teacher training and Pilates teacher training schools that we had regulated up until last year when that was when that change was made by this committee, by the legislature. And so that would impact the workload and the fees gained by the within this unit, which is noted in the fiscal note.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so then the regulation, I think I got it now. All right, so that's reflected in the fiscal note. So let me ask, do we have a list? Can we receive a list, please, of the 13? So each of the sections that you talked about of the change, you said one of them would regulate 13, and then you weren't sure of the next one, less than that. Can you provide those institutions? Because I would have loved to hear from the institutions also about this legislative change, because it seems like a pretty big one. So if we can have that list, I would like to actually have a conversation with some of them to see if, one, if they're aware of this, and two, what do they think about this change? And maybe we can't do anything about it because you're saying that there's a federal ruling, the Armstrong case. So if you could just provide those institutions that are affected by this change, thank you.
Mr. Wald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick. Yes, and thank you for that. I believe that it is 13 institutions under 657, which is the registered schools. And that isn't to say that there aren't other programs out there. However, the fee structure does not provide for fees for changing a program or getting a program added any longer, which was another change that was heard and made by this committee last year when we updated and simplified the fee structure. So there may be more affected programs. I don't have that, but those would be at some of the larger institutions that are already registered. And these 13 that I mentioned would be new institutions that are wholly exempt under this. Every program that they have is exempt under this, and they would require registration. But I can definitely get that list.
Representative Rarick.
Yeah, thank you. That answers those questions. And I would just note, too, for the public that it is my understanding that we were asked to speak to our amendments and withdraw them. And so I just want the public to know that our intention was to offer the amendments, have a conversation about it, and vote on them. But we were asked by the co-chair here to withdraw them. So I think that transparency is important. And, you know, things change, and I get that. So I can understand that that's a big change. The other thing I would say is that it's really important for those of us, myself and especially Chair Robbins now, to have conversations with OHE in advance of these things so that we can fully understand, you know, some of these very technical changes that we're talking about making. And that did not happen. So I appreciate that we're having this conversation in public, but I think that I would like to revert back to the time when we actually had conversations in our offices so we could fully understand the bills that are being brought before us by the agency so that we can have that understanding before we come into committee. So I would ask that
that we would revert back to that policy and that that courtesy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Rarick. Members, without objection, we will revert back to the A5 amendment, which was offered by Representative Novotny. I'll take the liberty to paraphrase Representative Novotny. The A5 amendment was the surety bond requirement for private schools maintained at may deposit a greater amount at its own discretion. Would the team? Oh, excuse me, Representative Duran. My apologies. Representative Duran was the person who brought forward the A5 amendment. Would anyone from the team at OHE care to offer input on Representative Duran's A5 amendment? Mr. Wald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Duran, this change, if I understood you correctly when you were explaining it, I don't know that I have the same understanding that you do with regard to this change. The may and the must does not change the offices. The office's responsibility to do anything in here. It allows the office the discretion to require a private career school to submit more amount in bond if the office determines it to be necessary. If the office determines that the private career school may have more risk of closure based on any of its funding levels or anything that might be a finding in audit, and we believe that there might be a higher risk of closure or any sort of student harm, then we could ask for more than 10% of the preceding year's net revenue to be deposited on bond. Right now, as the statute exists, it states that there shall be 10% of the preceding year's net revenue from student tuition fees and other required institutional charges, but in no event less than $10,000. If we want to say that there's a school that would have 10% that is less than $10,000, we'd be happy to take a bond that would be less than $10,000. So there's not that minimum requirement anymore, but this does allow the office the discretion to say, in this particular scenario, this school is at higher risk. And so for that private career school, again, generally smaller schools, not as savvy as a lot of our registered schools are about a lot of things, we can ask for a higher bond level in order to have more security for the students.
Are there any other members seeking to ask questions or offer input on the important conversation of the A5 amendment? All right. With that, now, Representative Novotny, we're going to go to your we will revert without objection to the A7 amendment, which Representative Novotny, if I could have the liberty of paraphrasing, maintains that the work-study allocation for student internships should be for public and nonprofit employers only. Would anyone from the team at OHE care to chime in on Representative Novotny's A7 amendment? And if so, please state your name for the record and proceed with your comment.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Megan Flores. I'm the Director of State Financial Aid Programs at the Office of Higher Education. I can speak to the changes related to the work-study program. There were three changes. The first one is on line 1.21 related to selecting students for participation and enrollment. We did engage with a monthly advisory committee of the financial aid folks across the sectors in the state that I invite together monthly for meetings. And what we had heard from our institutional partners that in practice, this is not entirely possible nor practical because when students are packaged for their financial aid offer, it's oftentimes well before the student has registered for classes. Definitely that's true for new students who don't register until they come to new student orientation, which tends to be in August, sometimes in July, but definitely, 5 to 6 or 7 months before the school packages the student. So there's an assumption about enrollment, but there's really nothing that we can do if the student's enrollment goes up and down, which very, very commonly occurs where a student goes, up and down in their enrollment. But, most of the schools, they assume it's full-time enrollment, but the students might change for classes up until the first week of school or even after that with an instructor signature. So that's the reason for that change, is just that it's not something in practice that's entirely possible nor practical. although, you know, we do hear from our institutions it's their intent, but we can't really regulate an intent. To the second question about the federal, the part where state work study overlaps with federal work study, which is online, starts on line 2.9, related to our law says a reasonable effort to place work study students, and this is related to off-campus employment. The federal work study program has a requirement, so it's not a reasonable effort, it's a requirement. Our schools do struggle to find off-campus employment. That became more difficult during the COVID pandemic and has not ceased to be a challenge for them. So through our stakeholder consultation, they've mentioned that this community service requirement is difficult on the federal level, and since the federal level is more stringent with the requirement, and our state level is softer in that it's a reasonable effort, and they struggle to even meet that 7%, they're just not finding it possible to meet that at the state level. So that is the reason that we proposed that change for that program. On the final change related to the split between the graduate and undergraduate students, based on our observation, you know, this just is not really happening for schools that have both undergrad and grad. The focus is definitely on undergraduate students, but there are definitely more opportunities for undergraduate students off campus and oftentimes higher wages than there have been ever before. And so schools are finding it harder to attract work study students. This allows them that flexibility at the campus level based on their local population to make a decision that makes the most sense for that campus when there is a mixture of undergraduate and graduate enrollment. I'm happy to answer any questions related to this part of our change.
Thank you very much for that. Members, unfortunately, we are out of time for today, so I will be moving to lay this bill over, but to be taken back up so that we can make sure that we have a thorough conversation on this and that all of our members get the opportunity to ask any questions and receive whatever input they would hope to receive on these issues. I want to thank the Office of Higher Education for taking the time to come and meet with us and present this information. I want to thank members for their thoughtful questions and attention during this hearing. And with that, the bill is laid over and this meeting is adjourned. Next time. Okay.